Today's episode of Gluck Radio is proudly brought to you by Audible.com. Audible.com is the premier provider of digital audiobooks, offering titles in every genre. Now, I want you to go and get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/gluckradio. There are over 150,000 titles to choose from your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. If you're a fan of this show, you might like to download American Savage by my fellow podcaster and sex advice columnist, Dan Savage. Or how about Crush It? Why now is the time to cash in on your passion by Gary Vaynerchuk. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/gluckradio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/gluckradio. Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. The biggest blessing and joy in the world, they say, is to have children. Yet why are there countless studies ranking parenthood as the most miserable, lonely, and stressed out job that there is? Jennifer Senior, author of the best-selling book, All Joy and No Fun, joins us to talk about the effect modern children have on their parents. What happens to parents when it comes to everything from sleeping to sex, marriage to socializing? Changes in the last half century have radically altered the roles of today's mothers and fathers. Many of you listening have children and will have strong opinions about what we're going to talk about. Division of household chores, sleepless nights, overparenting, and raising those dreaded creatures we call teenagers, which was the most fun part of my life. Parenting is a paradox, and we'll try to unravel it right here and right now on Gluck Radio. Jennifer, welcome. I appreciate you being here and discussing probably the most important topic that there is.
Oh, thank you. My God, I don't know if I can live up to that framing, but I'm really delighted to be here, so thanks.
So let me ask this question. People need licenses to cut hair. They need licenses to change oil. They need licenses for doing your nails. What's the deal with parents having absolutely no responsibility to know anything before they become one?
Well, here's what's funny. I mean, that in and of itself is a very modern perspective, right? Because it suggests that parenting is this rarefied thing that we do and that it's extremely important, right? And of course it is. Of course it is. It's hugely important. But from an evolutionary point of view, the idea was, I mean, my God, the species wouldn't have continued if there were some kind of bureaucratic hurdles to making it keep going. So, you know, it has to be like the lowest bar of entry possible. What's interesting now is the kind of immense pressures, I think, that all of us feel to do this well and to do it right. And I think that some of those pressures are probably warranted, and they were a long time in coming. You know, for a long time, children were not treated well. They were treated as sources of labor and all that stuff. But on the other hand, I think that the pendulum has almost swung in this direction where, you know, we are making such an excruciating kind of fetish about, like, being perfect parents that everybody pays a price for it. Grown-ups pay a price and kids pay a price because, you know, that they sense their parents' anxiety. So I think, you know, it's tricky. I don't know how picky we should be about this, right? I'm conflicted myself. Like, on the one hand, yes, I sympathize. Like, why can any old schmo become a parent? You know, of course. But on the other hand, you don't want the standards to be so exacting. You know, I mean, parents are in the habit of judging each other so badly.
See, I would say the whole judgment issue is something that is problematic because part of the problem is that so much of parenting is trying to be the better parent or to be perceived as the better parent. And so much of the pressure put on the child is not for their good, but for the you know, for how other people see them. I think that was the most aggravating part of my childhood. My, you know, mother would wave my 100, you know, my test where I got 100, you know, before her friends. And I couldn't really give a damn and put unnecessary pressure. But it was really all about them. And you're right. I think the bar was low in terms of the survival of the species. But at the end of the day, is that all we want to do is just survive?
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, that's the whole point, though, is that right now we've gone way from that extreme, which is, you know, I mean, that's not the goal anymore. And, you know, it's important to remember that, you know, even a couple hundred years ago, you know, we were having 7 or 8 kids per family, you know, in order to ensure that most of them kept going. But, you know, we're now at this point where it's quite the opposite. You know, we wait. I mean, now, look, in Plymouth Colony, I guess that was longer than a couple hundred years ago, but in Plymouth Colony, there were 8 kids per family. And in 1850, there were still 5 or 6, depending on the, you know, the records you look at. And today, there are 2, just 2. So we have a lot of expectations riding on the experience, and we assign a lot of value to those 2 kids. If that's all we're going to have,
and in some countries there's just one. I know my wife from Romania, and every one of their friends, just everyone had just one child. The one child policy in China, so it's you're right. It's 1 or 2.
Right. So you're. I mean, imagine. I mean, this is the basic principle of economic scarcity speaking. You are assigning a lot more value to things that are rare than things that are not rare. So you have already this heightened expectations around having kids. And then compound to that the fact that if you are a college-educated woman, the odds are you're going to have your first baby at 30.3 years old. And if you're a college-educated man, you'll be about 32.3. So, again, imagine how many expectations are riding on this experience once you finally have it. I mean, this is the equivalent of what marriage was in a Jane Austen novel. It's the finish line. It's this capstone to a life. It's this great thing that you are racing toward, right? So there is a lot of, I mean, now we just have, I mean, the standards for parenting and what we expect for it are like higher than a bird's nest. I mean, it's really super high. So I think that is in some ways what's very, very different.
I love the fact, by the way, that you said 0.2, because I always love when people give statistics and they're even. Like, this star is 76 billion light years away. Like, how about in 4 feet?
Right. You
know, so I really appreciate that. That, you know.
No
let me ask this question. Should everyone be a parent, and is there anything wrong with simply not wanting to have children? Because personally, I find that the only people I think should have kids are the ones who really, really want them.
Right. I mean, I definitely think that there's nothing wrong with remaining child-free. I mean, if you want to lead a life without having kids, and I think that if you want to have 7 kids, you should have 7 kids. I mean, but I think what you said is the only thing that matters. I think that, like, you have to want it, right? I mean, it has to be something that, you know, you're prepared to do. But, you know, I don't try and weigh in. I mean, the one thing about my book, I will say, is that, you know, I worked scrupulously hard to make sure that parents, when they read it, saw their own lives reflected back and were able to articulate, like, after reading it, what made their lives distinct right now, why modern parenting feels the way it does. I tried very hard not to make a single judgment. This was very neutral. It was, you know, kind of descriptive, not prescriptive. You know, it was not judgy in any way. There's that gym train called Crunch that says no judgments. You know, I mean, I really tried hard. I don't judge. So I wouldn't want to weigh in on who can be a parent and who couldn't. I mean, the only thing that I think is really essential is that, you know, you want the job.
Right, exactly, that you do want the job. I think the judgment is important not to have, in the sense of that is the greatest fear that people have in their entire world is to be accepted without judgment. So
yeah.
If a parent doesn't judge themselves and is able to put themselves in a learning position, then that's really, really, you know, wonderful. But the biggest resentment I find, you know, with my clients is that the child really believes that he's a pawn or a tool for someone else.
Totally. And then you're casting your child in the role of either antidepressants because you want them to make you feel happier, and that's not good, or proud, right? I mean, and that's that, I mean, I think that you've got to be careful, and kids sense that, and you sense it. It's not good for you. You don't want all of your self-esteem riding on your poor kids. You know, I think that here's something that I think is really interesting. I mean, Jerome Kagan, you know, the developmental psychologist at Harvard, who I guess experienced kind of his heyday in the 70s, but he pointed out in a much more recent essay, it was probably in the late 90s or late 80s that he wrote this in the New Republic, he pointed out that we have so few ways of showing ourselves as moral creatures in the United States, that we have so few ways of like showing in public how we are moral, because we're no longer civic leaders. We're no longer participating in civic institutions and volunteering for things at the same rates. We're no longer taking care of our aging parents. We're putting them in nursing homes. We're warehousing them. You know, because we don't do these things anymore, one of the only ways to show what fabulous moral people we are is through our children and then through a very, like, public displays of child-rearing, that it's this way that we sort of show our plumage by showing what terrific moms and dads we are. And
yeah, but Jennifer, isn't that pathetic? I mean, isn't it, you know, I mean, didn't, I don't know how young you are, but I grew up, you know, with TV shows, The Waltons and you know, and the shows where you were a family and you didn't throw away the old or the useless, and that, you know, you stuck together, and that was one of the great things about being a family. What happened to that?
Well, you know, if you want to read somebody like Robert Putnam, who has written about the decline of social capital for years, I mean, that's a great sort of place to start looking, I suppose. You know, he wrote this book, Bowling Alone, in 2000, that every president or presidential candidate has sort of been, like, looking to since about, like, why that tries to... He does the same thing, actually. He sort of looks at the phenomena. He does give some explanations, but I mean, there are lots of reasons. So why are we not as cohesive anymore? Why are we doing this? I mean, some of it has to do with the fact that, you know, we live in a sprawling universe. We don't live as close to one another. We have smaller families. The Waltons had a lot of kids. You know, our kind of forms of entertainment are individual. We don't need others to entertain ourselves. You know, like, the idea of socializing used to involve everybody sitting around a piano, but now you can stick two phones, you know, two earbuds into your ears and listen to, you know, anybody playing the piano brilliantly, which is on the one hand fantastic, but on the other hand, it doesn't mean you don't need anybody else to do it. You know, we can substitute kind of volunteer work for giving a ton of online giving, right? Which is, again, great in that, like, we're funneling lots of money into charities through the internet, but we're not necessarily there in real time. So, you know, some of it is technology. Some of it is urban and suburban sprawl. Suburban sprawl and exurban sprawl. We live further apart from our neighbors, so we don't see them as often. You know, we're living a much longer time, and we're working far longer, you know, kind of further into our lives. You know, we're not retiring at the same age as we used to. So elder care is hard for us if we're still working ourselves and if there's fewer people around our own homes to take care of the elderly. So, I mean, these are, you know, and family sizes are getting smaller. So these are a few reasons that I can give.
In your research, who are the happiest children and who are the happiest parents and why?
Well, that's interesting. I tried very hard to figure it out who the happiest parents are. You know, because there's data out there that suggests pretty consistently that parents aren't as happy as non-parents. And I think it has nothing to do with the children. It's not children who are making them unhappy. It's, you know, it's parenting in 2015 that's making them unhappy. It's something about the way we parent and the immense pressures associated with parenthood. So I was trying to figure out in those data sets, you know, if there was any way to determine who the happiest slice of parents were. And there's not. It's very frustrating. They're all done anonymously. It's very hard to know. I mean, I can take some guesses, you know, which is that generally speaking, religious people are happier. And I think that religion adds a structure to people's lives, and it gives them rituals, and it gives them things to do, and it gives them moral superstructure. The problem is if you're not religious, you know, you can't kind of authentically start that kind of life. It's very hard. But my suspicion is that people with religion and families with religion, I think families with habits are probably happier, families with, you know, well-defined routines, because a lot of what modern parenting looks like is extremely ad hoc, just kind of trying frenetically to keep up with stuff. And by the way, I fault no one for this. My family does it. I feel like in some ways that's the story of my family.
Jennifer, how many children do you have?
I just have one. I was allowed only one because my husband had two from a previous marriage. So if you add up everyone, it's three, right? So I'm a stepmom to two who are now fully grown, and one's in college and one is launched, and I have a 7-year-old. But by the way, in New York, you know, where things are cramped and, you know, we only have one bedroom for an extra person. So that's, you know, if we had any more, we'd have had to like pile them in, you know, and hope that they were the same sex, I guess. But, you know, I feel like everything is done ad hoc and everything moves very, very quickly. So I think that having rituals probably helps. I think giving kids chores makes parents happier and makes kids happier, strangely, because kids secretly, they want to feel independent and they want to sense their own agency, right? And parents need a break. So they're in the habit of being their kids' valets in this kind of homework extracurricular complex, and it's very tiring. So to the extent that you can, like, give kids chores again, which they used to have in spades, I mean, they used to have real responsibilities around the house. It's probably good for everybody.
I think you brought up a lot of good points, but I would probably start out with that the happiest parents, I have two and they're grown, they're 36 and 32. But that the if you start out with people who are genuinely happy with themselves and really kind of are not filled with guilt but filled with excitement, and nothing is a mistake, just a learning experience, you're going to have a much happier home. And I absolutely believe that time, family time together, which is hard, meaning I wasn't able to have that because I had to work. My wife took care of the children, and unfortunately she had cancer, breast cancer. She eventually died from it. So, you know, that became hard to have family time. But the amount of happiness within the home is one of the reasons why kids stay close together. One of the reasons why they scatter to the four corners of the earth is to get away.
Definitely. It's very hard to know how to respond to that. Because, I mean, first of all, I'm sorry, I didn't know that about your wife, but I mean, that's a you know, big kind of hole in the middle of everything. I mean, that must have been very hard. But what I would say about happiness at home is that, yes, of course it's true, and of course you have to start with being happy yourself. But, you know, the only reason I take issue with that is that, number one, it's tautological. I mean, naturally, if you're happy, your house is going to be happier. Yes, of course. Like, that stands to reason. You know, I mean, that's sort of circular. But the problem is that there are many people who don't start out happy or whose circumstances don't allow them to be particularly happy, even if they have, you know, either they start out with a slightly less happy temperament, a slightly more melancholic temperament, or a slightly more anxious temperament, or life circumstances just kind of like don't allow them to be as fully realized as they'd like to be because they have jobs that they have to take in order to support their families, and they're not ideal, or they're in places far away. So, and I don't think that people like that should be told not to have kids. I think that people who are melancholic or should be allowed to have kids, and that people who have less than ideal jobs should be allowed to have kids. I mean, these are part of life's basic fulfillments. And what you do, if you can't actually, if you don't have like a perfect temperament, or if you don't have a perfect kind of circumstance in life, I think that the other things that I was mentioning are things that are more within your control. Developing family rituals, giving your two kids chores, you know, I think those are things that you can at least exercise some control over. Those are fixable, you know, whereas the other stuff, you know, they might be harder to fix.
I had with my children, you know, a couple of interesting scenarios. Like, for instance, my wife, we married fairly young, I think 20 or 21, I'm not too sure. It's a long time ago. But she first of all needed to sleep, and I did not need to sleep so much. And she would always worry that, you know, if the baby was crying. So I would say I would just take the, you know, the baby, and my first one was definitely a crier, not my second. And I would take the baby and I would go to the other end, you know, of the apartment, because we grew up in an apartment, and I would just, you know, put some music on and let the kids scream for as long as they wanted to. I didn't care. Didn't bother me at all. And then the next day, the kid was so tired from screaming all night that, like, the child was just wonderful.
Yeah,
you know, my wife said, "How did you do it?" I said, "Ah, you know, just magic. Kids love me." But the idea, if you don't get nervous that children are different and they have different behaviors, and that you can't try, you know, to fix every little bit of their behavior, and you somehow have to, you know, somehow have to mix that up with the fact that there is interesting technology, that children learn faster when they're growing up now, that if you expose them to different languages and music and so on and so forth, they will absorb them faster. There's an interesting combination in that.
Right. I mean, the only thing I would say to all of that, you're telling the story from the point of view of, like, so the lesson is, you know, don't get nervous so that the kid, you know, because the kid will sense it. I'm thinking about, actually, because I tell this as a story about how kids affect their parents, right? I'm looking at all this from the parents' point of view, you know, and trying to sympathize with their plight. I'm thinking about this as a story between a husband and a wife and how this plays out in a marriage, which is what my second chapter is about. And my immediate thought was that you were probably not being quite as hard on yourself as your wife was being, that one of the reasons the baby screaming might have made her anxious is that she felt like she needed to stop it.
Absolutely. I wasn't hard on myself at all. And you're 100% exactly right.
Yeah, that. So she felt like being part of the deal with being a good mother is that you had to mollify your baby, whereas you thought, you know what, I'm a good enough father. I'm good enough. Like, this, the baby, the fact that the baby is right now not particularly easily consolable doesn't reflect badly on me. I mean, the baby's just going through a crying jag, and I've got to ride it out, and I'll turn on the music and do what I have to do, and then the baby will eventually grow tired and go to sleep. And, you know, your kindness to yourself during that, you know, that episode, I mean, I wish that more of us moms could sort of borrow some of that and could feel some of that. And I sort of point out toward the end of that chapter that we would all do very well to sort of maybe rip out a page from the playbook of the really good engaged fathers in our lives, who we know, who might be our husbands or might be other people, who, no matter, they're just not as rough on themselves as we are on ourselves, ever. Like, the best fathers I know and the most engaged ones will still cut themselves far more slack than all the moms I know. So that, to me, is a lesson that you just, you know, you shrug it off and said, like, I didn't care. And listen to you. You're not telling me that you were a bad father because of that.
No, absolutely not.
Said, yeah, but if a mom said, I don't care if my kid cries, she would be publicly shamed. She'd be shamed on Facebook. She'd be shamed, you know, everywhere, you know, she went. And she can't even say that out loud.
Yeah, so, like, I mean, how pathetic is that? You know, it's interesting because I had to, and when I say I had to work in order to pay the bills because I was the only provider, and I worked extremely long hours. So my method for dealing with my favorite age for children, favorite, are teenagers.
Yeah.
Okay, and the way in which I did it is, even when they were small, is that every night, like after, I think, fourth grade, I would take a different one, and I would wake them up at 2 in the morning or 1 in the morning, even on a school night. And I would take them to have ice cream. I would take them bowling. As they get older, I'd take them pool. As they get older and older, I took them for, you know, to a bar. And I would always, and we'd have this special time. And they would go back and they would tell their friends. And it was like, it was so cool because they're disoriented. And what the heck are we doing? And don't, you know, tell mom. Not that mom cared. She didn't probably care because, you know, she knew this was my way of the, you know, making a continual bond with the child. And I have to tell you, I didn't have one hard day with either one as a teenager ever.
Well, I mean, if you're going to be waking up your kid to take them to a bar in the middle of the night, then there's no way that they have nothing to rebel against.
No, absolutely.
There's an ingenious strategy.
My kids never had curfews. And you know what? They didn't have it, and they came home, you know, reasonable times. Meaning,
yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for that, for the self-regulating. And some kids, I will say that, like, if you'd had a third or a fourth or a fifth child, that might have backfired eventually, because one kid might have just, because they were wired differently, they might have, like, taken that as a cue to go off and, you know, stray. You never know. Some kids are also just extremely kind of well-regulated and self-regulated without, you know, any interference anyway. But it sounds like you also, this was like kind of a good strategy for the kids that you had, that like you just, by doing this, you gave them absolutely nothing to kind of chafe against, right? So that's a very fun, I mean, I'm going to throw that into the, you know, kind of archive. I mean, I love hearing stuff like this because, you know, whenever I hear about parents who are flipping out, I can point out, you know, that there are alternative models and that, you know, maybe one of the answer is to put your kid on a longer leash, not a shorter leash.
Jennifer, also to disorient them. When it's 1 in the morning and they're an ice cream parlor, they'll tell you everything. Okay, or if they're playing pool, you know, and everyone is like getting a kick because it's the only kid in the pool room, you know, and they're the star, they'll tell you every secret that there is to know, and you're non-judgmental, and they just get used to just talking to you.
Well, that is fascinating because, you know, what I often hear from parents of teenagers is that the only way they learn about what's going on in their kids' lives is if they're carpooling them, because then they're sitting in the back seat with two friends and they start chattering. And that's how you learn a lot. That and that you also, you know, because they've got all these devices of their own, like their own laptops and their own cell phones at a certain age, they can't actually know what movies they're watching and who they're texting and who they're on the phone with and who they're, you know, kind of who they're just interacting with. So the only way that they can figure all that stuff out is by snooping, by making a choice to actively monitor them, because they can't passively monitor them. You know, my mother, if she wanted to know who I was on the phone with, she simply had to answer the phone, and then she would pass it over to me, and she'd know. You know, and if she wanted to know what I was watching, she just had to stand in the den for 10 seconds, and she'd know. You know, whereas, like, we can't know these things without actually prying open their laptops or grabbing their cell phones. So, you know, this is a very interesting kind of scenario you're giving me where you get them in a disinhibited state to begin with. I'm not sure I'd recommend it, but, you know, I don't give child-rearing advice. I mean, my book is about parents. It's not about their children. You know, it's not a parenting book. It's a book about parenthood.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I do. This is, you know, what I do is I give advice. So, and I do say this: every single parent is different. Every single child is different. Okay, so, you know, with disciplinary action, I had two kids. This is something, by the way, that Facebook would go crazy and right. Have my police knocking on the door. But my younger one, Melissa, her name in Hebrew means honeybee, and she really was. She was the sweetest thing in the world. And I would come home, and my wife was more high-strung, and I would come home, and she would meet me at the door, you know, with the belt, and she said, "Dad, today I think I need to get hit twice because I did this and I did that." You know, so we go through the ritual. I come up and I spank her twice, and she give me a kiss and say thanks and walk away happy as it could be. You know, and this is she was, you know, she did this since she was, you know, 4 and up. And my other one, God forbid I put a finger on her, she'd throw herself down the stairs, you know, and she would like go crazy. So I could never, ever, ever physically, I'd have to sit and discuss it with her. So in the same house, there were two different types of parenting, you know, style, because one responded so well to the idea that now it's over. Okay, you know, and I had to force myself not to laugh and be serious because it was just so funny.
And the other was just a very different kind of kid.
And the other one was a different kind, meaning like she took any type of spanking so personal. It just couldn't be done, so it wasn't done.
Right. Well, and now it's very seldom. I mean, I don't think that any, you know, child-rearing expert would condone, you know, laying a finger on a kid now. I mean, times are so different, you know, and it's something that, you know, I definitely, I mean, it's just something my cohort doesn't, you know, tries very hard not to do and doesn't do. But, you know, these are changing mores. But, you know, again, I feel reluctant weighing in on how one raises a kid because my book is not about parenting. It's about parenthood. It's about how, you know, it's really about the effect that kids have on their parents. So, you know, I mean, I don't really get into, like, any kind of parenting styles or what we do or what we don't do or what works and what doesn't work.
I want you to talk about how since, because this is, you know, part of your book, how does marriage and children affect one's marital, the sex life? The sex life, and how does it affect the marriage? How does having kids affect the marriage?
Right. So it's pretty, there are very tangible effects on marriage, right? I mean, if you look at any kind of chart of a marriage and how people are rating their well-being in their marriage, it's higher before the kid comes along, and then there's this dip, right, the second the kid comes along. And part of it, I'm sure, can be kind of attributed to sleep deprivation. But I think here are the big things that go on. I mean, first of all, in terms of sex, you would be surprised at how little research there is about how kids affect one's sex life. We all know anecdotally that it affects it, right? But looking for good longitudinal data that will say, like, how kids affect, you know, a couple's sex life over time is hard to determine. Number one, because it's hard to, like, isolate that variable.
Plus, people lie.
I'm sorry?
People lie.
People lie. They lie. Also, the longer a couple is married, the less sex they're probably going to be having anyway. So trying to figure out, you know, how much the kid, you know, affects that is very hard to do. And also just, it doesn't seem to be the way that people ask the question. They seem more interested in asking this question according to age, you know, like how old you are and how much sex you have. And they seem to be interested in, like, sex immediately, like during pregnancy. But it's kind of hard to find. You know, I mean, and you can find some data that says that, you know, I mean, that says what we all suspect, which is that people are having it less. But it's hard to say how much less and how this changes over time. And what happens when I just speak to couples is that what people say is that it's not the sex they miss so much, it's just the intimacy, feeling tied to one another, and that's what sex does. And that's what's really, you know, like, crucial to kind of regain. Because there's a third person in the house. You've gone from a dyad to a triad, so you're triangulating everything. So, you know, that what sex, you know, does is reestablish a bond between, you know, the parents. But I think more important, and what I spend more time sort of talking about in the book, is the way couples start really arguing about chores. I mean, really arguing, because women are now, while I would not say that they are fully saturated into the workforce, they are mostly there. You know, 4 in 10 moms are now the primary, if not sole, breadwinners in their households. 4 in 10. So 41% of us make some of, if not all of, the dough. So given this fact, you would think that we would have arrangements at home that would reflect this new reality. But we don't. Women are still doing twice as much child care, and they're still doing twice as much domestic work, which means that couples are really fighting about this stuff. And also, women do all of the deadline-centered work. Not all of it, but, you know, in the main, women are the ones who do the deadline-centered work at home. You know, they're the ones who are anxious about getting food on the table on time and making sure the homework is checked and making sure that, like, the kids are, you know, are in the bath by a certain hour. And women are the ones who are multitasking at home. Men, when they are at home, are not multitasking. Men multitask outside the house, not in the house. So that's a very, you know, kind of sore spot of tension. And women wake up 3 times as much in the middle of the night with their kids. And that's if they're working. If they're not working, it's even more. So, you know, there's all this stuff that suddenly gets churned up where men and women are fighting about whose time is more valuable. There's this kind of scarcity economy at home where people are sort of diving for the free hour so that they can get, like, the nap in or the bike ride in.
Honestly, I think that women have always had it harder, you know. And I don't know if you remember the old John Lennon song. It's the title now is obviously taboo, but this is Gluck Radio where nothing is taboo. Where the name of the song is, you know, "Women Are the Niggas of the World," and what he meant by that obviously wasn't racial, was that they are the ones that are treated the worst.
Huh.
You know, they are the ones who really, you look at the world and where does the burden always lie? It lies on the woman. And, you know, to some extent, I think that is becoming more and more true. because women are in many very often earning as much as men, and they're still doing most of the chores.
Right. That's exactly it. So it's falling disproportionately to them. You know, and there's this counter argument which says, well,
I hope my wife is not listening to this. I'm remarried.
I'm
so I said, I'm remarried. I hope my wife isn't listening to this. I do as much chores as you, okay?
Yeah, well, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, you know.
I don't really.
I mean, yeah, right. I mean, women still do more. I mean, here I think is the difference. You know, if you look at the numbers, men still do more paid work, and women do more unpaid work. You know, that women don't work as long hours. So, I mean, there's this argument that people sometimes make, well, look, if you add up the number of hours everybody's working during the week, it's close to even. Women are still working a little bit more, but it's, you know, close to 50-50.
I'll tell you, Jennifer, though, why it's not, because women do the boring work. Okay, meaning I love going to work because it's exciting and it's new every single day. I wouldn't want to, like, you know, wash the dishes, you know, and do the laundry and do the same routine every day. I would lose my mind.
Well, you're exactly anticipating where I was going. Exactly. What I was going to say is the problem is that not all work is created equal, and some work is a lot more fulfilling and less stressful than others. Now, I shouldn't say fulfilling because, I mean, raising kids is fulfilling. But, you know, I think that it's – but tending house and dealing with your kid in the middle of a meltdown and trying to get them to put on their socks and to put on their shoes and to pack up their lunches and to hover over them while they're doing their homework, all those things are enormously stressful, right? And so women do not experience their time in the same way. So a really good example of this, I was really surprised to read this, is – if a woman thinks she's getting a raw deal in terms of child care in her house, and by the way, that doesn't mean that she thinks the child care should be split up 50-50. It just means that she thinks she's getting a raw deal. She just thinks that her husband could be doing more relative to the other stuff. You know, that the husband's taking a pass and doing yard work instead of helping out with the kids, you know, or something like that. If a woman thinks that she's getting a raw deal in terms of child care, her marital satisfaction is going to go down by a full standard deviation. And that's not true if she thinks she's getting a raw deal in laundry, you know, like if she thinks she's doing too much laundry or if she thinks she's doing too much dishwashing. It's true for only taking care of the kids. So then you have to ask, well, why is that? And I think a lot of it is because of the things I was saying before. You know, there is something about the kind of time that women spend with their children that is uniquely stressful. You know, they're the ones who are the bad cops. They're the ones who are doing the nagging, who are doing the deadline sensitive work. Women are the disciplinarians at home. It's not men. This is true across ages. Women are the ones who are the bad cops. This whole wait until your father gets home thing is a myth. You know, time after time, women are singled out as being the disciplinarians. Men think that their wives are the disciplinarians. They don't think that they're the ones who do it. And women think that they do it. So, you know, there's all these reasons. And they're doing three things at once at home. Women, in general, multitask 10 extra hours a week. And all of that multitasking, every hour of it, is at home. So home is not a haven. Home is this place of keen discombobulation and time fragmentation.
And I think you're absolutely right in what you're saying. And since my practice is one of giving advice, I think number one, I think the whole idea, well, here we have a difficult situation because most of the parenting at this point is done by Facebook and it's not done by the parents, and that the children are learning more and taking more from the social media than they are their parents themselves, which is really a problem. Fathers absolutely, those might completely disagree, but I never really did care about that. Fathers need to not be the ones that necessarily discipline, but they are the ones who, in the idea of being a parent, is being a mentor and a teacher. And I love the idea of chores and lots of them. Okay.
Yeah.
I think that children who have the most responsibility, you know, tend to be the happiest. And when they're rewarded for their responsibility, and rather than being punished, You know, when you know if you're bad, I'm going to take this away. I think if you're if you somehow break the rules, you have more chores, extra work. And not only do they get a sense of satisfaction that they really paid their debt, but they're much, much less likely to do the same thing twice if they actually have to do more chores.
Right. I mean, I definitely think that one of the things that mothers could do to make their lives a little easier is insist that their kids do certain things for themselves. And it won't alleviate their load particularly. I mean, you know, you can't get your kids to do everything, especially when they're little. But I think it would certainly help. You know, Facebook is a funny thing. It's a mixed blessing in terms of parenting because, you know, you can very quickly get responses if you write on Facebook. You know, my kid seems to have, like, a first-degree burn. Anyone have any thoughts about this? The Internet says this, but I'm wondering whether anybody's actually dealt with this directly. You'll get 7 replies almost instantly, and it's really great, you know. Or you could say, we've just gone through, you know, the Judy Moody series of books, and now I need something else for my kids to read. What does everybody love out there who has, like, you know, an 8-year-old girl? You know, what do you read? And you'll get lots of replies, and it's really terrific.
And you're right. I think technology is great, but I also think it really, really would be great if parents realized that sitting around, you know, and reading a book, you know, as a family and having some family time together, if that's economically possible, is still pretty cool. Meaning parents, the kids don't see their parents as cool anymore. They see their parents because, you know, they kind of, the kids gang up on one another. You know, it's a complaint fest about their parents.
It's a complaint fest, right. Well, I mean, I think that there are reasons for that. I mean, and I think that, I mean, I'm not sure whether or not as a parent, our objectives should be to be cool anyway, right? I mean, I think we want to make sure that it's pretty clear that we're the parent. But, I mean, I think that, although people might differ with me about that, but, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the reasons kids might complain about their parents, I mean, it's an interesting thing. There's this gulf now because they, number one, they're very, very sheltered now. They live in this bubble. They're kind of wrapped in bubble wrap and tissue paper. And so, again, if you give them more responsibilities and more things to do in the house so that they have a sense of the family economy, it's better. You know, starting in the 20s, child labor was banned, and it's a good thing that it was, right? But one sociologist had this great line about it. She said that kids went from being, she said that kids became economically worthless but emotionally priceless, right? So that's when, like, the really aggressive sheltering and nurturing of kids began. And what happens is that they start to live in their own world, particularly once kids stopped working. What they started doing was going to high school in droves. They stopped dropping out of high school, right? And even in 1940, half of all teenage boys were dropping out of high school to go work. So it wasn't until really after World War II that the sheltered, you know, education-focused childhood as we know it came into existence. And once kids were in high school full-time, and what childhood looked like was very uniform. It was K through 12, this forced march through the grades, and, you know, lots of extracurricular activities now, you know, and even, I mean, I guess people had jobs after school in the 50s, you know, there was more kind of like working after school and sort of not as much homework. But as the world became more competitive, kids started, you know, doing lots of extracurriculars and all these things. And, you know, so now childhood kids are sealed off in their own worlds. They're in high school all day, right? They're in school all day. They're in these kind of kid-centric worlds. Then they have kid-centric entertainment. They have kid-centric after-school activities where they're not going to work with adults. They're going to soccer practice. That's their new work. It's with other children. They're going to, you know, they're doing the school play. That's with other kids. They're not working side by side with adults. They develop their own culture, you know, because they're with each other all day long.
Absolutely. And the fact is that that is a good thing. That they have more social interaction because it does balance them out, you know, somewhat. But also I find that one of the big problems is that internet related, is that parents share diseases that they place on their kids that the kids don't have. They go to certain professionals, and again, you know, I am... you know, I do executive life coaching and hypnosis, medical hypnosis for 37 years. There is definitely a time and a place to address the underlying anxiety and fears that kids have. But very often they'll take them to a professional who will put a label on them, okay, and kind of warehouse them through that label rather than just, you know, working out the problem.
Right. I mean, that's pretty common. And again, I think it speaks to the pressures that parents feel right now to kind of raise super children, right? So that it becomes clear to you that, you know, your kid cannot. I mean, here's the thing. There's this big, the middle class has been shrinking very rapidly in the United States. You know, starting in the 70s, wages began to stagnate. And starting in the 80s and really the 90s in earnest, there was globalization at this furious pace. And, you know, now when kids are competing for jobs, they're competing for them with kids all over the world. And so parents are sort of seized by this economic terror that they have to raise this perfect kid so that they'll, not perfect, but like this high-achieving kid so that they'll go to the right college so that they will be able to keep a toehold in the shrinking middle class. That's what all of this is. It's so that they can maintain their middle-class prerogatives and have a shot at a middle-class life. And in order to do that, you have to raise a very accomplished, increasingly, a very accomplished kid. So if, you know, you discover somewhere along the way that your kid is not as high-achieving as you wish they would be, what you might do in order to mitigate that or to give them, you know, extra time on tests or to get them extra help is, you know, seek out a doctor's assistance in giving a label to them, which might, you know, or identify, like, something as like a pathology that might really be nothing, you know.
Right, but Jennifer, there's also, not that I don't disagree, but I would think the first thing you do is you take a kid for testing and find out what it is they're really good at. Because what, you know, today, so many kids have, you know, college is just a useless piece of paper and just something you need as an entree in order to go to the next step. But those who are tested and they love a certain profession and they take apprenticeships and they learn how to be entrepreneurs, these kids are very often the most successful economically.
Right, right. I definitely think that that's true.
I have friends who dropped out of school, you know, but loved being an electrician, and the guy is actually a billionaire.
Yeah,
you know,
he has the largest
electrical company in the world.
That's amazing. Well, I mean, so here's the thing. I mean, sure, you know, if parents could relax enough to, like, kind of stare at their kids and see what their kids' strengths are and lean into those strengths, it would be easier for all of us. The problem is that there's a lot of noise around you telling you that your kid has to succeed in a traditional way in order to get ahead. And, you know, there are lots of critics of the current system about, you know, like what kind of values, you know, what kind of priorities we place, you know, we have in our educational system and what qualities might really serve a kid best and which kinds of, you know, kind of paths after school, you know, would help them most. Is it college? What kind of college? Does it have to be a fancy college? Can you drop out? You know, and I think that, like, we would all be better served if we thought about, yes, like, what skills might best serve, you know, a kid. Here's the problem, though. I'll just say this. You know, the world is changing so rapidly, it's very hard to know what skill set will best serve your kid. You know, we don't really know. We're not raising our kids to be like us. You know, and so what we do as good conscientious parents.
But let's go back. We should not be raising our kids to be like us. Okay. But most parents do that. They want the child to be an extension of themselves, and that's part of the problem.
Right. But the other face of that problem is that if you've decided, no, I don't want my kid to be an extension of myself, I want them to be ready for the future and to be as optimized for the future as what they could possibly be, you don't know what the future is going to look like. So what you do is sign them up for everything, just hoping that one thing will be useful to them, right? You know, you're trying desperately to figure out what they can follow through on and what their passion might be. But it means signing them up for a lot of things until you figure that out. And that's exhausting to parents.
Oh, no,
and that's really tiring.
Jennifer, we could go on and on. You wrote such a great book and have, you know, so many good insights. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but you are wonderful, and your book is wonderful. And
thank you so much.
I really thank you for being a part of Gluck Radio today.
Oh, thank you. It was really fun. Thanks a lot.
Bye now. I want to once again thank Jennifer Senior for coming onto our show. Go pick up a copy of her book, All Joy and No Fun, on Amazon.com. And also, check out her website at jenniferseniour.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. I am your problem solver. I want you to check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com and on our YouTube channel at Errol Gluck. You have to visit my website, glucksolutions.com, to learn more about how hypnosis with coaching can actually change just about anything in your life. Life is precious. Don't waste a second of it. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in with what you want to hear. Till next time.